you're passionate and patient, you're gonna succeed. I had an idea. I wanted to start a business. I wasn't like, oh, I need a co-founder. It's like, oh, maybe I need an engineer, but not a co-founder. So I wasn't thinking about it. And you know, when you have an idea that you want to materialize, it's not the first thing, oh, what's the playbook of starting a business? You know, let me see what other VCs have done. Like, maybe I should have a co-founder first and whatnot. You just start it, you know. For me, finding the business model was a question of time, not a question of, you know, and then there is a little bit of the nimbleness, you know, trying to understand, okay, what works, what doesn't work. Sometimes you have to stay the course, but not for too long. It's an art. It's not a science. First of all, I don't see a downturn.
Okay.
Not in VC. I mean, there is cool down. People have realized, okay, well, maybe we've invested way too much money in stupid stuff. So there's a bit of a cool down, but there is still a lot of money out there, and that money has to go somewhere. So, and for better or worse, and I think it just, the whole system producing way too much money. You know, some people here in Bulgaria, real estate is a thing. You know, everybody buys apartments in Sofia because that's the only thing you can actually invest in. But ultimately, when you start looking around the world, it's either the public market, so invest in equities, and that's why the equities have been going up, because there's so much supply of money, even though the underlying fundamentals may not be there. And the other place is in startups, but through VCs, because a lot of people are not qualified to invest directly into startups. And so they would put the money into VCs, and then VCs have to invest the money. And so that perpetuates the model. I don't think things are going to change anytime soon. I think when real downturn happens, that may shake out. But a real downturn is something like the economy tanking 20-30% down. Okay. That's why I don't abide by the rules of the venture capital industry. Yeah. And the venture capital industry, for better or worse, have shifted away from what it used to be. I mean, I have, as investors, both in Atinfo and now in Adam, I'm one of the original founders of Bessemer Ventures. You know, guy invested in Sun, Cisco, all those companies and stuff like that. And when you talk to him, he's like, well, back in the day, we just saw good companies with good founders, and they invested in straight equity, and there was no, you know, limitations of, you know, I have to exit in XYZ, we have to get a board seat and whatnot. It was pure venture capital. Now, over time, because people saw how much money it makes, they started raising money, they have LPs, they have to respond to other LPs, they started doing preferences, they had to do all kinds of other things to control the situation so that they don't lose money. That always is actually, in my opinion, in the long term, against the founder. So I'm sure there's a lot of businesses that have died because the VC pushed them too hard. Well, the fittest survive. You know, some businesses really have grown, but I don't buy into the narrative that growth is what you strive for as a company.
This podcast episode is supported by EBRD. Support to small and medium-sized businesses is an important part of the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development's mandate. Activities to support small businesses include direct and indirect financing through partner institutions. The EBRD's Advice for Small Businesses team provides the knowledge, the network, and the skills to help emerging businesses innovate, thrive, and succeed.
Hello, Recursive community, and welcome back to our podcast. My next guest has come a long way in his professional and personal development, from investment banking through digital media and marketing, over e-commerce and back to rethinking humanity's relationship with food. Viktor Panev is a serial entrepreneur and a founder and a CEO of the food database and tradition company, Edamame. He is also a mentor and investor in food tech startups and an advisor to early stage entrepreneurs. Before that, he co-founded and successfully sold Bulgaria's largest internet company, Netinfo. Join us to discover today the next steps on his journey. Viktor Panev, welcome to the Recursive Podcast. I'm very happy that you're here.
My pleasure.
We have known each other for quite a while, but only now, actually, it dawned on me that it would be great for you to share your wisdom, because indeed your career has been very, very colorful so far. You had been in many, many different industries, and it's actually quite impressive. And I would like to ask you about all these turning points that you had in your career, how they were motivated, how did they happen?
All right. How much time do we have?
We have, unfortunately, only an hour. If we don't have enough time, I would like to invite you again, because I also know that you have a big vision for the future. So
would love to talk about that too. Yeah.
To do a follow-up in a couple of years. So Let's start maybe from, it's always hard to define where is the beginning, but I would like to bring you back in time when you left for the US and you started back then also your career and ambitions. Why did you leave Bulgaria back then?
The simple answer is education. Mm-hmm. You know, so if you just picture Bulgaria back right after the wall fell, it was a very tumultuous, very exciting time. There was a lot of student strikes, a lot of movements back and forth and whatnot. And I guess I was just brought up with the idea that good education is what matters. And so I actually tried first to go study in England. I haven't been in the English language school here. I had British professors, so Britain was a big thing. I did actually get admitted to Oxford and Cambridge, but they didn't give me financial aid, so I skipped that. And I decided the next year I'm going to apply to the US, where there was financial aid. And I was actually aiming at the top universities and colleges. I applied to 25, got admitted to 11. Wow. A few gave me full right, and I just picked up the one that passed with all the money paid, and that was it. But the underlying reason was I was looking for a good education.
And did you have an idea of what you want to become when you grow up back then? What was your initial your choice?
As any young person, again, I mean, just given the context of the time, you know, I was in the army, 88 to 90, came out, the wall has fallen down, and, you know, everything was possible. So by default, every one of us became entrepreneur. It was gray market. We started doing things, you know, selling things, buying things. Started with a couple of my friends, our first kind of enterprises. So the entrepreneurial spirit started back then. So I always, in the back of my mind, was an entrepreneur just because of that formative experience. But when I went to the States, and I shared earlier in our conversation, my first love was physics and astronomy, and I actually wanted to study physics and astronomy. Turned out that I had already taken most of the classes that were offered in college, and so I decided to study something I didn't have chance to study in Bulgaria, so I signed up for politics, economics, studied a couple of languages, learned French and Spanish, completely changed my career, and so I ended up in a different track, but I've never given up on physics, so maybe one day I'll go get a PhD in physics and go watch stars.
Of course, why not? You mentioned that you had a couple of enterprises already when you were students. What kind of startups were they? Or we didn't call them startups back then. What kind of enterprises were they?
Well, that was not student. That was after the army. But actually, in high school, with a bunch of our friends, and actually my co-founder and Nadine, we started the student newspaper. So was a startup.
It was already a media company.
It was a startup. It was something that we actually hand wrote 2 pages,
really?
You know, every week, and illustrated. So there you go. But you know, after the wall fell and came out of the, I mean, there was so many things. You know, there were shortages of things and so on and so forth. So we ended up being in, you know, in one of those places that most people know, of a certain generation called Magura. Now, if you ask kids what Magura is, they'll tell you a cave. But, you know, the Magura was a place where people met and traded currency and all kinds of other things. So we actually started there. We did our first business there and then expanded from then on. Mm-hmm.
And you finished your education in the States and inevitably you ended up in investment banking? Or
it wasn't inevitable. I think it was great, you know, as a poor Bulgarian that ended up in the US, you know, I was like, okay, I need to make a lot of money. And investment banking was the obvious career back then. Even though I went to a college that wasn't driven towards business, it was actually the Pomona College to school produced a lot of academics. It's a very kind of academic environment. I was the black sheep there. I was the one that, okay, did something different, but I was older than everybody else. When I went, I was 23. Most of the other, my classmates were 17, 18. So I had a little bit of a taste of life and what I wanted to do. So I decided I'm going to go do investment banking. It wasn't as easy, but I lucked out at the time. JP Morgan was just opening their investment banking. So they were trying to find new recruits competing with other banks. So they would come to a place like Pomona College as opposed to all the Ivy Leagues. And I ended up on Wall Street for a couple of years.
Mm-hmm. So what did you give up on this career path later on?
I did not like it. It's a rat race. You work an obnoxious amount of hours without really making anything that matters. Mm-hmm. You know, it is somewhat driven by greed and by competition, and I really didn't like that. Mm-hmm. And I ended up in investment banking for technology, media, and telecoms, which for me was mm-hmm. something very interesting. And I learned a lot about the media space, which was my specialty, both in the US, then I moved to London, spent a year there. It was exciting, but at some point I realized, well, I want to do something, actually build something by myself. So on the day that I actually got a promotion to an associate level, I quit my job and came back to Bulgaria to start NetInfo.
How did the idea for NetInfo come up? And you actually got in touch with your former
We never lost touch. We never lost touch. Yeah.
Okay.
Very good friends.
Okay. So you basically shared your idea with your friend, Lubo, who is now at Launch of Ventures.
Yep, yep.
And you started the company. How did it come into existence?
It was very, very straightforward. You know, he had some businesses here in Bulgaria, but what I was doing, and it wasn't an original idea. I literally just copied something. So when I was in London doing investment banking, one of the assignments I had was to essentially help raising the C round for then the largest internet company in Latin America. Mm-hmm. And I wrote their offering memorandum, which was essentially a business plan for them. And I was like, okay, well, I have a business plan for an internet company. We don't have one of those in Bulgaria, so let's do that. And that was it. It was very straightforward. I came back, we went to the Black Sea with Lewin. We had a chat about it. He didn't know what the internet is. So it started from there. It's like, you know, what is the internet? Why do you need that internet? It's like, well, you can check the weather. It's like, I can look outside the window. Why do I need to check the weather? Anyway, we went to the office of a friend of ours who unfortunately passed away, but he worked in the presence. He had a computer connected to the internet at a 9.6K speed. And you know, we actually managed to do one thing. So anyway, rest is history. It was very, very early on. It was before, I think we started our company maybe 2 or 3 months after Dear BG started. So we were kind of one of the first mm-hmm. companies at all to start. Guvech was already on the scene, so to speak. Yeah.
NetInfo is actually still relevant part of the history of the Bulgarian ecosystem. Looking it back, maybe now, what do you think is actually the contribution of NetInfo for maybe laying a foundation for the tech ecosystem that we have today? Can you relate between the two events?
Look, you put me in different difficult situation because, you know, I mean, I do believe we actually contributed quite a bit, but, you know, I don't want to sound boastful about it. Mm-hmm. So I think what happened really, and I'm just going to tell it as a story, we were lucky to start early on and to have really good competition. Dear BG, I mean, we were all friends. Like, literally, our office was on Angyal Tikhonov 34 and Dear BG was like on Vitushka and I went literally 3 minutes walking away. And, you know, we had our servers in a kind of dark closet and theirs was under a desk. And it was, we knew each other, but we were competing. And because we were competing, we were getting better and better and better all the time. What that created is, first of all, an independent internet in Bulgaria Bulgaria is actually one of the few countries that withstood the onslaught of Facebook and Google mm-hmm. because we had such good ecosystem of competition. You know, Czech Republic, Korea, there is a few, Russia, but most of the other places where didn't have good competition and had maybe one or two players when Google and Facebook came and they got mm-hmm. wiped out. Yeah. So the result of that was that we started building an ecosystem of engineers.
Definitely.
Very early on, people that were building essentially the building blocks of the internet and amazing engineers. We were lucky over the years to have over 100 people that have worked with us as engineers. And some of those are one of the best engineers I've ever known. So that kind of created first a space to create engineering talent and for people to aspire to work in a place where they can work as engineers. And it also inspired a lot of startups. So over the years, we bought a few of those startups, you know, Hosting BG, Bbox, et cetera. Some of them we didn't buy, like Access Software. We were very much talking to Christo about buying the company, but we didn't. And it was better for him, I guess. But that inspired those companies to start something because they either saw that it's possible or they thought, well, maybe I'll sell the company to that team for, in any case. So the ecosystem, I think, got brought up by the existence of companies like NetInfo and DearBG, and Investor at the time also showed up. So all of those companies working against each other actually brought up the ecosystem.
I would also see it like this. I wonder how difficult was it back then to train engineers in working in a company like this? I guess in some ways you also had this culture of let's experiment, let's innovate, let's do things, maybe break certain things along the way, but let's try to be better than the competition. And I think back then this culture maybe wasn't that existent, or was it? I couldn't say.
It was, look, we didn't even think of those terms. There was not a culture of, you know, let's bring good engineers and, you know, teach them how to code. It was, we have tasks to solve. Can you solve it?
Okay.
and basically the people that could solve it quickly and easily, and so things don't break, those are the ones that rose to the top. And, you know, there weren't that many people, but there were some really brilliant engineers that had very creative thinking. And some of them, I mean, we created abv.bg, the email. I remember it took about a month to build the initial, and it started growing. And then at some point it broke. And I remember that within 24 hours, two engineers were managed to fix it. You know, something that I cannot fathom of people being able to do now. But, you know, it happened.
Have you ever tried maybe counting how many startups were created afterwards, or companies were created afterwards by former employees of NetInfo?
I haven't counted, but if followed the careers of some of folks. I mean, NetInfo felt like a child. So I still keep in touch with a lot of the people from NetInfo. Some of them are still actually with the company. A lot of them left, and some of them studied in other places. You know, they're folks that led other internet companies like Fashion Days, folks that started actually within the company in new products. But I haven't counted, really. But quite a few people actually went out and did their own thing.
Did their own thing and dared to do their own thing. Yeah, I think the spillover effect is amazing that you have created. I think you also showed that it is possible to create something like this in Bulgaria. And I'm sure that in some ways you also had a certain cultural influence because, I don't know, leaving space for innovation and creating space for engineers, you know, to get better over time, to grow with you, must have had an influence on how people are thinking. And this is why they also dared afterwards. I think once you show that you can make it, people start believing a bit more in themselves, because it is already hard to be an entrepreneur. You do need success stories and great examples. And of course, also the support of people who you look up to.
It was easy. You know, we were young and we didn't know we can fail. So, you know, if you don't know if you can fail, you just believe you can make it. And so, and everybody was excited because we were building something new that didn't exist, that, you know, people started using. I mean, this is, I think, the pride and joy of NetInfo. It's like when we sold the company, we had 3 million people in Bulgaria with ABV.BG account. So 3 million people use daily. That was for us a big accomplishment.
Do you remember what happened once you exited? How did you feel, first of all? You know, working on your baby for such a long time, you know, growing it and then, I don't know, handing it over in some ways. And what were your aspirations back then? What did you want to do next?
Yeah. Well, first of all, give credit where it's due. Lubin was the one that ran the company for most of the time. I ran in the last couple of years before we sold it. And to some extent, it was bittersweet. I mean, to some extent, yes, we were building something new. The sky was the limit. On the other hand, the company felt like a teenager, you know, grown up, ready to go take on the world on its own. It was profitable. It didn't need us. And I had also personal reasons why I wanted to leave. So with all of that, we decided, the board decided, we had a board, we're going to sell the company. The process actually is interesting because we had created a culture where controversy was very acceptable and decision-making was quite flat and democratic in a way. So we ended up doing a very long process. So when we sold the company, had to find a replacement CEO. We had to do a very long process of finding a replacement CEO. And the person that eventually, Krasianov, who became CEO, I think he went through 35 interviews.
Oh, wow.
And at the end, the entire company got and discussed for 6 to 8 hours between the two final candidates, and we voted and we selected the CEO.
Wow, that's a lengthy process. Okay.
Yeah, but because the culture was so strong, if the CEO came without the approval of the team, they would have been ejected. So when the team bought in, then it was easy.
And there was no one internal that you could have promoted because it could have been probably
could
easier,
have been. Yeah. We thought about it. We were a very young team, and nobody there was fully equipped to do everything. We had a young finance director, a young HR. It wasn't. We needed somebody with a little bit more experience. Plus, after all, we sold the company to Sanoma Media, and they wanted somebody with a little bit more experience. So anyway, long story short, I stayed on for a year to transfer everything to the new CEO, and then left. And I guess I was always an entrepreneur. I knew I was going to start something. I took a year off, though, and I recommend it to everyone. You know, if you can take 6 months, a year off, you know, clear your mind and do something different.
How difficult was it for you on a personal level to, trust them later on a new CEO that they're going to take care of what you have created? Maybe for you and also for Lumen, I can imagine that it is a process. I mean, it's already a process for an entrepreneur to delegate at some point to people in the team, but
It wasn't that difficult. Okay. No, once you decide to let go, it's easy. And you have to trust. And trust is something that either you have or you teach yourself to have. But once you trust that, you know, things are in good hands, just kind of let go.
Same thing. It sounds so easy, whereas trust is one of the most complicated.
Any parent that has a kid that is gone out of, you know, and gone into the world, you have to trust that they're going to be okay. You know, if you worry constantly, you're going to be miserable.
So. It's true. So the entrepreneurial bug stayed with you.
Yeah, it never left.
And never left. Even the Pomona College couldn't actually, you know, convert you into an academic. Okay, so how did the next idea come into existence?
On a beach in Thailand.
That's a nice place.
a nice place during the detox. So just to rewind, I love cooking. I've been cooking for over 30 years. I love food. And I actually was looking to start a media company because in Antifu, we ran a newsroom and everything. And I saw that the news world is starting to slip sliding down a slope that I didn't like. And I was like, okay, maybe we can create something that is more truth seeking. And I already had ideas and whatnot. And then on the proverbial beach, I was sitting one day just around New Year's. And I was like, well, I think about food 4 or 5 hours a day. Might as well do something about it. And so started thinking of, you know, how to combine my two passions of, you know, food and technology and what we can solve as a problem there. And then I devoted maybe 8, 9, 10 months of my time and money to research, you know, what we can do. Ended up with the idea for Edamame. So.
What I find interesting about Edamame is that you started it a bit different than startup founders are starting it now. So you don't really follow the classical startup model where you go fundraise, you start something. How is it this model actually now allowing you to navigate the company through the different economic stages that we're going through. How long has it been since you started at Amman? When was that?
12, 13 years.
That's a long time. Yeah. So you've seen actually different economic stages in that.
Yeah. Look, if you love what you do, keep doing it. That's as simple as that.
Yeah.
I was lucky to an extent because we had sold NetInfo. I had some cash.
Yeah.
I was able to finance to some extent everything at the beginning. I raised money, but I raised money from friends, family, angels, and whatnot. I haven't raised money from venture funds. Mm-hmm. Or not the traditional venture fund funding. And that has given me peace of mind because there's no pressure to do anything from a venture fund. I don't have to abide by somebody else's schedule that in 3 or 5 years I have to show a return and we have to close the fund and we have to sell a portfolio. That is not playing in. Everybody that's on the cap table of the company is somebody that has bought into the long-term vision of the company and its patient capital. Mm-hmm. And that helps.
Of course. I'm thinking still, how did you feel confident about the business model in the beginning? Because in some ways, you know, VCs could be also used to validate if the business that you want to grow is actually going to have traction or not.
I didn't feel confident about the business model. You know, as a matter of fact, it took me about 5 years to get to a business model that worked. But I did... I was conscious enough of that pitfall. And so what I created, and I didn't have a co-founder, which usually helps, you know, to have a second mm-hmm. opinion. But what I did do very early on is start building an advisory board.
Okay.
And so for me, those are the sounding board. This is the sounding board of people that actually help to bounce off questions when you have doubts or when you have issues and whatnot. And also, I have learned not to panic when things go south. I needed to be too joyful when things go well. So, you know, a little bit of a steady state helps quite a bit because inevitably there are plateaus and there are downturns and whatnot. And so for me, finding the business model was a question of time, not a question of, you know, and then there is a little bit of the nimbleness, you know, trying mm-hmm. to understand, okay, what works, what doesn't work. Sometimes you have to stay the course, but not for too long. It's an art, it's not a science. So, but I wasn't confident at all.
I think it's actually very difficult, especially without a co-founder in the beginning, because there are certain topics that you can't really discuss with friends, you can't discuss with your husband, wife, you know, boyfriend. They're not really in this position. So the sounding board that you were building around yourself, was it mostly people who were in the industry or were they also entrepreneurs who can relate to the entrepreneur?
A little bit of both. Okay. You know, some of them entrepreneurs, some of them experts in particular fields that were important to the company, whether it's food tech or, you know, technology. So it was a very diverse board, but people with quite a bit of experience. Mm-hmm. And people also that were willing to help, you know. Mm-hmm. So and it's up to the entrepreneur at that point. You know, how often do you pick up the phone and call them and say, I have a problem? So mm-hmm. if you don't do it, it's not very useful, but if you do it, it's great.
Was it a conscious decision not to have a co-founder? Did you realize at some point that maybe that's the mode that you would operate better, or?
No, I think it just happened, right? Okay. I had an idea. I wanted to start a business. I wasn't like, oh, I need a co-founder. It's like, mm-hmm. oh, maybe I need an engineer, but not a co-founder. So I wasn't thinking about it. And, you know, when you have an idea that you want to materialize, it's not the first thing, oh, what's the playbook of starting a business? You know, let me see what other VC have done. Like, maybe I should have a co-founder first and whatnot. You just start it, you know. So
they do have, some of them, they do have this checklist, you know. They're like, this is investable, that's not investable. Yeah. Red flag if it's a solo founder, red flag if they have too many founders.
Right. That's why I don't abide by the rules of the venture capital industry. Yeah. And the venture capital industry, for better or worse, have shifted away from what it used to be. I mean, I have... as investors, both in NetInfo and now in Adamam, one of the original founders of Bessemer Ventures. Mm-hmm. You know, guy invested in Sun, Cisco, all those companies and stuff like that. And when you talk to him, he's like, well, back in the day, we just saw good companies with good founders and they invested in straight equity and there was no, you know, limitations of, you know, I have to exit in XYZ, we have to get a board seat and whatnot. It was pure venture capital. Now, over time, because people saw how much money it makes, they started raising money, they have LPs, they have to respond to other LPs, they started doing preferences, they had to do all kinds of other things to control the situation so that they don't lose money. That always is actually, in my opinion, in the long term, against the founder. So I'm sure there's a lot of businesses that have died because the VC pushed them too hard. Well, the fittest survive. You know, some businesses really have grown, but I don't buy into the narrative that growth is what you strive for as a company. And that's what VCs are for, because growth equates into return.
It's their asset, more attractive for the next level. Do you think that the current economic downturn is going to correct these inefficiencies that we see in venture capital businesses?
No, I don't think so. First of all, I don't see a downturn.
Not
in VC. I mean, there is a cool down. People have realized, okay, well, maybe we've invested way too much money in stupid stuff. So there's a bit of a cool down, but there is still a lot of money out there, and that money has to go somewhere. So. Yeah. And for better or worse, and I think it's just the whole system producing way too much money. And there's only few places that people can put those money, you know, the money. So it is, you know, some people here in Bulgaria, real estate is the thing. You know, everybody buys apartments in Sofia because that's the only thing you can actually invest in. But ultimately, when you start looking around the world, it's either the public market. So invest in equities. That's why the equities have been going up, because there's so much supply of money, even though the underlying fundamentals may not be there. And the other place is in startups, but through VCs, because a lot of people are not qualified to invest directly into startups. And so they would put the money into VCs, and then VCs have to invest the money. And so that perpetuates the model. I don't think things are going to change anytime soon. I think when real downturn happens, that may shake out. But a real downturn is something like the economy tanking 20-30% down, and you know, which is
I've been thinking, maybe it's not you who I should ask, but I still see that you have certain reflections on the topic of venture capital. So if we have to, I don't know, create like a VC fund that is truly aligned with the interests of the founder, which most of them have on their websites,
right?
What would be the main thing that needs to change, in your opinion?
It's very simple. You have to have patient capital, and you have to invest at the same terms that everybody else on the cap table is invested. So there's no preferences for the venture capital firm. And then it becomes, the interests become aligned, because everybody has the same economic interest and the same horizon of when the exit might happen, if it happens. And so I think that's what's needed. And there are funds like that out there, but they are very few. You have to find them. And they usually are started by ex-founders, you know, that they want to somehow help.
Yeah, they've been through the whole thing. Earlier, you mentioned that you needed around 5 years to, I don't know, find the right model for Edamom. I'm thinking that, you know, from the perspective of patient capital, that's not a long time. At the same time, it is a very long time. How patient were you with yourself? I mean, 5 years, especially in the life of an entrepreneur, sounds like an eternity. I mean, I look back at my year and it feels already like 5 years. And this is like almost 25 years knowing the roller coaster. And even if you manage to calm yourself down, the life of an entrepreneur, I believe, is very eventful. There, every day there is a new thing that you need to solve, and
Well, a couple of things. First of all, if you love what you do, keep doing it. So it wasn't a question of me whether to do it or not to do it. I did something that I really liked. I worked with engineers and people that love cooking, and we were building something that actually had an impact. And that was exciting. So for me, it wasn't, I don't know, 5 years, 1 year, it doesn't matter. You do what you love. And at some point, if that changes and I find something else to do that I love, then, you know, I will change. But it wasn't, okay, we'll try something. If it doesn't work, we'll go on to the next thing. There is a little bit of that concept of explore and exploit, you know, and you have to exploit an idea for a long while and persist through the, you know, plateaus to be actually become really good at something. You know, if you're a piano player, you got to play 10 years straight a few hours a day to get to a level that you're really good. You know, the whole concept of 10,000 hours, you got to put 10,000 hours to become really good at something.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think a lot of entrepreneurs give up at that point where it becomes things start looking very dark and I don't know what's going to happen and can I pay the salaries and all that stuff. And then I just throw the towel. And this is where exactly you have to persist because things are going to look up after that. And I think I learned that lesson early on. And I also got just about the time when I started a company into meditation and contemplative practices and whatnot. So it was somewhat easy for me to keep a steady ship with everything, the tumults of up and down of running a business, you know, a little bit of breath work, close your eyes, go in a different space, evens things out. And so you can take everything and you realize, you know, it's just a business after all. The sun is still shining, you know, there are museums to go to and friends to talk to. So.
Mm-hmm. I remember at some point I was talking to, I think it was Christo Borisov who, you know, shared that, you know, when things get really crazy, it's actually where he would slow down on purpose.
Yeah.
So that you can still think. So meditation for you was the way to deal with the roller coaster in an emotional way?
It was a practice. I wouldn't say that I used it as a tool.
Okay.
I do meditate every day, but it wasn't a tool to manage.
Okay.
It was a practice to enter into the space of, as the Buddhists say, the non-attachment.
Mm-hmm.
And so whatever happens in the world, it just happens. You know, you just got a bucket of nice ice cream, awesome, you know, but nothing big changed, you know, or you just lost your wallet, well, happens. So it is that non-attachment attitude that meditation brings into the world of a person. And then you can deal with the ups and downs of life a lot easier.
I can almost guess your answer, but I think it's still important to ask. Isn't it also partially because we're so attached to the idea of being successful and winning that makes us successful entrepreneurs? I would like you to challenge that idea.
Well, we have to define what successful entrepreneur is.
Of course.
Yeah.
Of course.
So if you define successful entrepreneur as somebody that makes a lot of money in a very short period of time, then being competitive is an asset only to an extent.
Mm-hmm.
Because this is also one of the most destructive things that you can have is being competitive. You know, and there are good examples and bad examples. You know, Instagram got started within a year, they got sold for $1 billion. Awesome. But, you know, look at Uber, you know, big company, interesting company, but the competitive nature destroyed the culture and a lot of people. So the company almost, you know, went away. You know, they got a new CEO, you know, brought it back up to life. But if you look at the stories of companies that across the board, not just the successful ones, you see that 99 out of 100 times, people that are operate competitive actually fail. Because you do have to have kind of the cooperative spirit and the long-term impact vision.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, going back to the days of NetInfo, actually we were all building the internet. Even though we were competing with each other, we helped each other because we all building the internet. We had an association. We talked through things together. And I think that's very useful when you have that competition attitude and the fact that you're not focused on how much money I'm going to make next year, what's the profit of the company, but what is my impact? How many, you know, how do we measure Adamant? We measure it by number of people that use our data. And because we have deals with Microsoft and Amazon and the like, we reach over 1 billion people. For me, that's a real impact. You know, I'm not as focused on the financials. And that's why taking money from a VC could be very destructive because you're focused on the financials and not the impact.
Mm-hmm.
Ideally, the two are aligned, but it doesn't happen all the time.
How competitive were you or are you?
I was very competitive in the beginning of my career when I was investment banking.
Yeah.
You know, but at some point when you realize, I mean, you know, all of us subconsciously, consciously ask ourselves, what's the purpose of life? What do I do? You know, what's important for me in a day to day? And over time, I've come to a couple of truths that for me define what good life is. And one of them is, you know, be in the present moment, you know, here and now. And the other is help others. And so when those are the motivating principles of building something, competition kind of fades away. You know, it's all about helping other people. And oftentimes I'll go help competitors. You know, I see they're struggling. I'm like, hey, I see a problem here. Can I help you with that? Because what I've learned in life is when you give, you get.
I find it very interesting how you came to these conclusions, because from today's perspective, I'm listening to you, and I don't know, someone maybe on the podcast would be listening to you. Yeah, you're actually a good person, but I think the process is actually very interesting. That, you know, at least for me, when you think about the purpose of life and giving, getting, and that it's not always like you're making a calculation on a piece of paper and then you look at the bottom line and then you see, okay, is it a good number or not? Often you give in advance and maybe at some point you will get, and maybe it won't be from the same person, it will be from someone else. It's like, I don't know, checking your karma account every now and then. This is how it feels to me. It always felt good for me to give in advance and then test a bit also people. Are you going to trust me that I don't want to screw you? Because this is also difficult. In any case, what I wanted to ask you is, and by the way, another thing that I wanted to throw in. Recently, I did a personality assessment and it would check like, you know, different aspects of my professional skills or, I don't know, qualities. And it would show me my top five, but it would also show me my weakest five. The weakest one was competition. And then I was like, oh my God, I'm not a good entrepreneur. I don't have any competition. It's like my weakest.
I don't think that makes a good entrepreneur.
Yeah, but I was surprised by myself. I always thought that somehow entrepreneurs, they, and especially tech entrepreneurs, I'm not a tech entrepreneur, but especially tech entrepreneurs, they need to have this competitiveness. They need to want to be number one, because if you're number five, you're irrelevant, yeah, in some ways. Yes, you do have the infinite game and, you know, all these wonderful things, but you still strive to be in the world one of the best ones.
Yeah. Well, but how do you define number one? Is it the biggest impact you have on people's lives or the most revenue you bring in?
That would have been my next question. So how do you know that what you're doing, if you're not competitive and you don't measure yourself against other companies, or maybe you do, how do you know that what you're doing has impact?
Because of
it
our clients.
Positive impact.
That's because of our clients.
Okay.
You know, so ultimately, we measure success by our clients. You know, if our clients use us and they, and we sell to businesses and they sell to their customers. So ultimately, you know, if the products we're building are having an impact in the world and that we can see that through our clients, this is the true measure. Mm-hmm. It's not the measure of how other competitors come is doing or not doing, et cetera. And as a matter of fact, I mean, we've been around for a while. We've seen two waves of competitors come and go because they're all competitive. They all compare, they all raise money, they all failed, they all went away. And we're still here. So that's the way it goes. And as a matter of fact, there's, because if your personality test, I've mentored maybe about 120 companies in the last 12 years in various startups. And my specialty is exactly the dark moment. When things are about to fall through, and I talk to the entrepreneur and usually kind of give them a pep talk. But what I've discovered is the people that really succeed, they have only two characteristics. One is passion. They really love what they do. And so every day is a bright day because they're loving what they do. And the other is patience or persistence. So whenever things get hard, you got to keep going, put the foot in front of the next foot and just keep going. And competition is not there. If you're passionate and patient, you're going to succeed.
For me, thinking about the competition is quite often just disturbing. It's just like, you know, it's distracting me from what I'm actually trying to do. So I tend to look away. I don't know how healthy that is, but I just tend to look away. I'm thinking we're going to do the things our own way and we'll see what how far
we get. Mental health is very healthy.
I think so. Okay. So a couple of things that I wanted to ask you about. Okay. So you are exactly also in the role of the mentor, of the advisor. What about your mentors?
What about them?
Who are they? What did they give you? How did you find them?
Well, it is, I don't think that was a conscious process. When I talk to someone that I think I can learn from, I engage with them, and it's never a straight up question, oh, would you be my mentor? Actually, I always shy away from people that ask me directly, can you be my mentor? Because it feels like transactional, you know, relationship. Usually we find something useful in the relationship. And so I have something to learn and they have something to give and they actually want to give it willingly. I have gravitated towards, at various points, you know, there's things that are interesting to me, you know, particular knowledge about food, for example, or about technology, or about investing. And so I've gravitated to people that have that knowledge. You meet them in very serendipitously in all walks of life. You know, it could be just sitting in a restaurant, you know, and they're on the table next to you and you overhear a conversation, and you strike a conversation. Mm-hmm. Or it could be, you know, somebody set you up, you know, because it would be a good conversation to have, or they may be an investor that somebody sent, you know. So there was no particular method to the madness other than I just captured the moment. And if somebody showed up that, you know, felt like this should be the right relationship, we just went for it. Mm-hmm. So
is this the way that you also pick up your mentees? You mentioned that if someone approaches you with the straight question, hey, can you be my mentor? And yeah, you doesn't really make a good entrance.
Yeah, I tend to help people that truly need help, and they don't know. And they come to me because they've tried other things and it hasn't worked.
Mm-hmm.
And oftentimes it's in the context of not a formal mentorship. You know, I mean, I've been a mentor to startup accelerators, et cetera, and then you get assigned a company based on the knowledge of the industry, based on the stage of the company, et cetera, et cetera. For some of those companies, it was very straightforward. I have a marketing problem. What have you seen in the last 10 years around that? And I can tell them what I've seen. But oftentimes it just happens, you know, talking to companies and an entrepreneur, usually first-time entrepreneur, has hit a wall.
Mm-hmm.
And, maybe there is something about me being an entrepreneur too and just being open to talk to them, but they kind of say, oh, here's where I am. What would you do in my place? And that's when the mentorship happens. It's not like it's not a formal mentorship. It's not like we sit down, we make a time and we're going to sit down and this 1 hour, we're going to be mentoring you and that's going to be over and you're going to be perfect. And it doesn't work that way. So
it's true. Now, I do remember that it happened the same way in our last conversation. I wasn't intending to talk to you about stuff, but it somehow, you know, it feels like I can share and you would relate to that, I guess.
Been there, done that. Right?
Exactly. Exactly. I think sometimes we entrepreneurs, we do need to talk to peers because many of the things we cannot share with friends, family, husbands, wives, and employees or even co-founders, you know.
Yeah. I have two such groups. Edamame is part of a big group called Startup Health. 400 companies around the world try to change the health and healthcare and whatnot. But we do what we call circles every 1 to 2 months. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's founders talk for 2 hours. Mm-hmm. And it's all cards on the table. You can say anything and everything. From personal problems to company problems to any joys and excitement that's happening, that helps quite a bit. And my other group is as ex-Stanford Business School. Mm-hmm. And so they are from all years, you know, 20 years younger than me, 5 years older than me. But we all have a group and we actually made a pool. Everybody's invested, basically committed that they'll share part of their profits from the company above a certain level. So we've made a pool and we talk to each other. And so when you have peers, it's very easy to actually relay those questions.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So Edamame is now still based in the US, and it's actually an American company.
Right.
But at some point you moved, or most of the time you spent now in Bulgaria.
That's right.
And you also started developing your own projects here in Bulgaria. One of them is actually dedicated to the topic of longevity. So I see that, you know, over time, health, not only food, but actually health has become a big topic for you. First of all, why did you come back at all?
For love.
Yeah. It's always like that. Okay. Yeah, I always joke with people that Bulgarian women are like one of the most important immigration factors.
There you go. Yeah. At least for expats.
At least for, well, also, yeah, exactly, for expats. Okay, so it's love. And you still wanted to reconnect with the local ecosystem and have an impact on the local ecosystem. Tell me a bit more about your longevity project. What are you aiming to do there?
Well, there is a few things that are happening around that space. So the big project that one day I hope to dedicate more time to is I would love to raise the average age of Bulgarians above 90 years.
Where is it now? I'm sorry for the ignorance.
It's in the probably low to mid 70s. We are, you know, last in the European Union.
As always, yeah.
Mm-hmm. But the upside of that is that we can improve very quickly.
True.
So
it's true.
So yeah. So that's the goal, and I do believe that food is a very important element of that. You know, I always go back to that because I mean, there's obviously sleep and exercise and contemplation, et cetera, but I do believe food is very important. And I kind of see underneath that, you know, overall vision, which is probably 30 to 40 year vision, a couple of subvisions that, you know, mini moonshots that we can achieve. And one of them is to create a regenerative agriculture ecosystem in Bulgaria so that regenerative grown food is cheaper than conventional food, which will change behavior of people. I think we can spend a lot of time on learning about the compounds in foods and the biopaths of acting those in the body of those compounds. So there's a lot of primary research to be done. And then there is the moonshot of precision medicine. You know, how can we combine everything that we measure to eventually into very seamless recommendations about what people should eat so that they can live longer, healthier life. But ultimately, you know, my belief is people can live up to 120 without any chronic conditions, without mental illness, if they live the right way. And so that is one of the projects. Separately, and this was more kind of very narcissistic of me, but I wanted a group of people around me, my tribe. You know, coming back to Bulgaria, was people don't live very healthy here. And so I wanted a tribe of people that live healthy. So I started talking to people. And within a couple of months, I realized there's a good group, and we gathered together in my home and started the Health and Longevity Clubs. And it's been going over a year now. There's over 530 people now, and we share information. We try to help each other live better, be healthier, et cetera. So this has become a side project, but it's also something very rewarding because you actually see people that are doing something about themselves and helping everybody else.
In fact, one of our former guests here in the podcast, Milena Gurgiva, I saw that she has given a lecture in your club. In this sense, if I may ask you, how relevant is actually food when it comes to longevity? I'm sure that it's a very complicated question and there is a lot of studies, but I don't know. I wonder if Bulgarians are the last when it comes to life expectancy in the EU. Isn't it related to healthcare system, poverty maybe? I don't know.
All of those to some extent play a role, but I think coming from outside and looking into what are the factors that impact longevity in Bulgaria, first thing is toxicity. So we live in a toxic environment here. You know, the air, the emotional makeup of people, all of that. And we eat very unhealthy food. I'm talking about Bulgarians. So if you go and look at what people are shopping in Lidl and Kaufland and Biller, I mean, it's pork chops that are raised, you know, for pigs that are raised with antibiotics and so on and so on. I mean, this is poison straight up. And so from that perspective, food is one of the things that you can actually impact. I mean, I don't know how much I can do to change the air in Sofia. There's other people that probably deal with that problem. And maybe people can just move to the, you know, grow their own food in somewhere in the countryside or live in the mountains, et cetera, that's all possible. But food is very important because it is what you put in your body. This is how you feed yourself and every cell of yourself every day of your life. Mm-hmm. So if you feed yourself with poison, you're gonna die. Mm-hmm. If you feed yourself with something that's healthy, you're gonna live long and you'll be happy. So it's very straightforward. I mean, it's not complicated.
Yeah. For someone who has been who has dedicated such a big amount of energy and also your time on the topic of food. Maybe I can, I'm going to ask the question like this. So let's say for those of us who would like to make a conscious choice about living healthy and eating healthy, where do you start? Because I have to say that it's been very confusing if you just, you know, open up the internet. First of all, if you have considerations which are about your own health, and second of all, about the environment. So at some point I was thinking, well, I'm not allowed to eat anything except for quinoa, basically.
Then you have to move to Peru.
Exactly. How do you...
No, there's, I mean, look, I have my own philosophy that I've built over time and that I kind of follow. So the very first thing is don't eat too much.
Okay. So
that is the number one problem in the developed world. People eat way too much. So they overfeed themselves, and that usually goes to obesity, diabetes, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So portion control is number one. Number two, remove processed food. So not any type of food. You know, I'm not saying be vegetarian or be a carnivore or whatever, just processed food. And processed food is pretty much everything that comes in a package and has ingredients that you don't recognize. You know, E450 is probably not something that grows in nature. So, mm-hmm. you remove that. Make sure you drink enough water. and then, you know, the old mycopollens, that just eat food, mostly plants, not too much of it, okay. And that's it. So, I'm not saying give up meat, but make sure you have a big diversity of food. And that's actually quite important for a microbiome where your health starts, mm-hmm. to eat as diverse food as possible. And diversity, some people have, you know, you have to eat 30 plants every week. It's actually not that difficult when you think about it, because, you know, coffee is a plant, chocolate is a plant, turmeric is a plant. But that's one thing. Now, I would say, it's not as easy to do in Bulgaria. You know, for me, I've now Tetrised my life into figuring out how to, you know, get the food I need, but it's a scavenger hunt. You know, you have to figure out which farm this food comes from, where they sell it, when it's available, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And it took me a while to kind of come up to a solution where I can actually get good food on my table, mm-hmm. consistently. That's something that we need to solve. That's why, you know, if we have enough regenerative farms, we'll create the supply, and eventually, especially if we reduce the price below conventional food, we'll start feeding people real food.
Mm-hmm. And when it comes to going into regenerative farming, how do you do that? You need to incentivize the farmers to, do into a bit more healthier way of growing plants? Or
yeah.
And animals probably as well.
It is very similar to the VC model. You know, do you want to grow a big farm with monoculture that produces cash, like, you know, grow corn or, you know, sunflowers, etc., or do you want to have an impact on health? Actually, regenerative farming is more profitable, but it doesn't abide by the economies of scale. Because to have a true regenerative farming, you create an ecosystem of plants that have trees, that have animals, you know, the cows are stomping on the ground, that creates certain things, you know, maybe hens are pecking certain grasses and whatnot. So all of that is an ecosystem, and you cannot scale it. It's not economies of scale, but you grow a lot more plants, maybe 30, 40 types of plants every season. And you can sell them at a good margin. And actually, your input is less. You don't have to buy fertilizers because you're not fertilizing. You know, it's regenerative agriculture. You have very rich soil. And the rich soil actually produces very, you know, plants that have high nutritional density. Yeah. And so you can feed yourself with less food. Anyway, it's a whole different story. It's a different way of looking at it. Are you looking at it as, you know, a cash enterprise, or are you looking at it as feeding the people? And so, you know, it's very similar to that. But there's a lot of movement, and there is a lot of interest, particularly in Bulgaria, of people to learn that. And a lot of people just don't know if they can make a living this way. Mm-hmm. And so part of that moonshot around regenerative agriculture is, let's create kind of a playbook of how you go back to the land and actually create a profitable enterprise to feed yourself, family, have a community, and help everybody else.
I guess also sharing success stories, you know, of farmers who are already doing it and they can afford their living. Do you see yourself going somewhere?
Absolutely.
Some point? Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, it would be interesting actually to start thinking of maybe also creating communities in a different way. I'm thinking sometimes, looking at my grandmas, yeah, and unfortunately 2 years ago, the one has passed away, but the other one is still living, and I'm looking at their lifestyle and reading also a lot about the happiness studies. I see that it's not only about health, but it's also about your relationships with people that have a huge influence on, first, how happy you are going to be, how you're going to manage stress, and subsequently your longevity. And it breaks my heart how elderly people in Bulgaria are living, because they live alone in cities. Yes, they do have families. Quite often they are also supported by their families. But the loneliness is something that kind of like breaks my heart. And I've been thinking, can we somehow reorganize society in a way so that these people are not, I don't know, somewhere alone in their apartments, that they maybe live in communities, they can relate to each other in a different way, that is not feeling like they're not part of society anymore.
We can, but it takes, you know, everyone doing something in that direction. Yeah. So we have to kind of wake up from the dream of, we need to make money to earn a living, to, you know, send our kids to good schools and stuff like that, and start reorienting ourselves to what's the meaning of life? Help other people, you know, be part of a community and whatnot. But it is hard because life moves at a very fast pace and you kind of go with it. And it takes a lot of effort and conscious effort to step away, take the risk, and then start building community this way. But yes, absolutely. That's the only way, to me, going forward. I mean, that's the only way we can save ourselves as humanity from the destruction that we're causing on the planet. So.
Mm-hmm. And coming from here, what is the next frontier for you? How does it align also with Edamom? How does it align with the projects that you're already also working on? You mentioned that you have a goal, increase the life expectancy of Bulgarians up to 90. Are you going to, I don't know, reorganize your life again in some ways?
It's inevitable. Yeah. I mean, well, change is inevitable. So and you have to flow with the change. I mean, there is always an emotional and psychological disturbance because you have to let go of one identity and kind of assume a new identity. Mm-hmm. Contemplation helps because ultimately you understand that you don't exist. There's no why, but you know. Mm-hmm. That being said, in a day-to-day life, you have to switch identities. Particularly with Adam, look, it is kind of like Netinfo. It's a teenager that's already grown, and you know, probably it will go, but it might be part of the solution. I don't know. It's a data company focused on food and nutrition, so it might be part of the solution. But yes, life needs to be reorganized and just go with the flow.
So it seems like you have this vision and you're currently now bringing up the puzzle pieces that need to go with it. I sometimes, as an entrepreneur, feel like I'm not even sure if I have the big picture. I just have like this blurry picture of where I'm going to. And then over time, I just pick up puzzle pieces that kind of like, okay, that's the one that I need right now. And that's the one that I need. And then, you know, over time, you see the picture becoming more and more clear.
Yeah. There's two ways to do a puzzle. If you've done one of those thousand pieces puzzles, you know, one is very methodically to go after, you know, I'm going to start in the corner here. And the other is like, oh, that piece fits here. You know, so.
I'm not famous for being very methodological. I enjoy going through life a bit with my gut, like, okay, and give the chance, life the chance to surprise me.
Serendipity is part of life.
So, exactly.
Yeah. As long as you keep moving, you're okay.
Thank you for this conversation. It brought me to certain thoughts that I've been having as well. It brought me back. I think maybe we do need a bit more moments where we detach ourselves from the rat race and start to reflect. I haven't meditated for quite a long time. You inspired me now maybe to go back home and...
No day like today.
Exactly. Do you do that every day?
Yeah.
Okay. How do you feel if you don't do it?
I don't know, because I never not do it.
You never not do it? Yeah. Oh, wow. Yeah. Is discipline an important part of your identity, or is it something that you created?
At some point, maybe it was discipline. Now it's a routine. It's part of life. It's kind of like brushing your teeth or, you know, making breakfast. You know, so I wake up, I do 1 hour of meditation every morning before I do anything else. And I don't even question it. It's just part of, you know, part of life. Now, what I've done is, which I lost when I came back to Bulgaria, is I removed by accident, by default, by, you know, way of life, my afternoon meditation. But now I've reintroduced it and I'm very happy.
By the way, I wonder, where is home for you?
That is... I mean, I guess home is where the people you love are. Mm-hmm. So that's where home is. I wouldn't put it as a geographic space.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I feel comfortable in many, many places. I've lived in a lot of places. I've lived in London, Paris, Sydney, San Francisco, LA, New York, and etc. I have a group of friends in almost every place.
Mm-hmm.
And so even if I haven't been there for years, if I call and call some friends, we go to places we love, we share stories, it feels like home. So.
Mm-hmm. I'm thinking that the idea of home changes for people who have spent a lot of time abroad. For me, it definitely changed over time. At some point, I felt home kind of like everywhere where I was, and I was feeling okay, and at the same time, nowhere, because wherever you are, you're always missing something from a different place.
Well, yeah. You got to be comfortable where you are.
Do you feel comfortable now in Bulgaria?
Yeah, there are things that I have to struggle again. Like the dirty air here really bugs me.
Bugsy.
Yeah, really bugs me. And it's something I cannot avoid. So, but, you know, I found my way to, you know, deal with it, with it every day and just have my routine. And so, yeah.
I feel that certain problems, well, maybe the air we can influence only to a certain extent, and there are entrepreneurs who are actually working on that, or at least raising the awareness about that, but it felt to me that in a country like Bulgaria, where we see a lot of problems, there are also a lot of market niches. So I'm actually curious about the next step of your entrepreneurial journey.
I'm curious too.
Yes. And on the last note, for anyone who would like to join your missions, what is the best way to get in touch with you?
Best way, the places I respond reliably is email. So victor@abv.bg.
Still an ABV?
Still an ABV, yeah.
Amazing.
I mean, that will be the easiest. I do check quite often LinkedIn and much less often Facebook. And that's about it.
Because I think it would take a village for these missions.
Yeah, but there are a lot of people that really want to give.
I think so.
And so.
Yes, and I think there are more and more entrepreneurs who are a bit pissed about the unhealthy way that we need to live in sometimes here. We want to improve that. Thank you, Victor, for being here.
Thank you.
And if you're just as passionate about innovation as we are, hit subscribe for the Recursive Podcast on YouTube or your favorite podcast platform. We're everywhere. This podcast episode is supported by EBRD. Support to small and medium-sized businesses is an important part of the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development's mandate. Activities to support small businesses include direct and indirect financing through partner institutions. The EBRD's Advice for Small Businesses team provides the knowledge, the network, and the skills to help emerging businesses innovate, thrive, and succeed.